Wah bam 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 bam.
This is Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Today we talk with Benmont Tench, the man behind the keyboards for Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. He's also backed up some of rock's luminaries like Johnny Cash and Bob Dylan.
The things that I've got to do, not just in the Heartbreakers, but if you are playing with an artist when that light shines through them and comes out, there's nothing like that.
We'll also review the new record from punk blues guitarist Benjamin Booker.
And 50 years on, we give Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band a fresh listen. Is it a buy it or a trash it?
That's all coming up on Sound Opinions.
This is Sound Opinions. Coming up, we're going to talk with Benmont Tench of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. But first, we've got some new music and some not-so-new music.
Greg, we all know what that fanfare is. 50 years after its initial release, May 26th, 1967 in the UK, June 2nd, 67 in the US, everybody is once again talking about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the eighth album by the Beatles, and allegedly, in many corners, the greatest rock album ever made. I think those are corners that have not actually listened to this record in a long time. I don't want to add to the tidal wave of media hype about the anniversary of this record, but for our listeners, let's give it a fresh listen. As rock critics, you and I believe very much in the importance of context. Great art doesn't come from nowhere. There's a place. There's a time. There was something happening when the music was made. But I think with Sgt. Pepper's, the story becomes all about context. The 60s and the baby boom and the summer of love. And, you know, there's this cliche, you really had to be there. But what if you weren't? I was three when Sgt. Pepper's was released. I've spent most of my life as a diehard Beatles fan, and I have significant problems with this album. You know, nobody who really loves the Beatles loves Sgt. Pepper's.
Oh, I don't know about that. I think there's a lot of people who love Sgt. Pepper's. I also think that it's an iconic album that in many ways people will say has stood the test of time. Why are we still talking about it 50 years later? I mean, there are plenty of albums that came out in 1967 that aren't getting nearly the attention. So why does this single album, out of all of their releases, get singled out above all the others? I think part of it, as you said, context. Here's the biggest band in the world, and they've told us two things. One, they're going to stop touring, so we're never going to see them on the road again. Number two, they're going to squirrel away in Abbey Road Studio and spend all this time making a recording. Now, we're still in the singles area here, mind you. The album had not yet been elevated to the point where, oh, this is the mark of a great band.
Look, when it came out, there was one critic and one critic only, Richard Goldstein, a pioneer in the New York Times when Sgt. Pepper's was released. He wrote, "Like an overattended child, this album is spoiled. It reeks of horns and harps, harmonica quartets, assorted animal noises, and a 41-piece orchestra. Those are just a few of the problems I have still."
I think, you know, when you look at this album and listen to it closely, to me, it's more about sound than songs. The songs weren't as good as the Beatles' previous records were. I still say Revolver, song for song, was a much better album. Rubber Soul, song for song, was a much better album. The sound was the thing. Here's this surreal world that they're creating in this album where they're basically playing a fake band. So the concept is the Beatles are Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, giving them the freedom to do just about anything under the sun in terms of sound, innovation, genre.
But they don't do anything good.
Well, you know, what they do good is using the studio as an instrument. So you're getting steel combs and toilet tissue and, you know, 41-piece orchestras all thrown into this mix. You know, guitars, drums, and bass just weren't good enough anymore.
Nothing to say, but it's okay.
Good morning.
Little signs of a band innovating in the studio and creating these little sounds and noises that really were elevating the idea of the art form of production. So
but
I think
self-consciously,
from that
where Revolver and Rubber Soul did not. Let me talk about the inherent conservatism of this record. At the height of a time of worldwide social revolution, political, sexual, racial, the Beatles are nostalgic for a time at the turn of the century, Victorian England perhaps, where everything was good, right? You have Paul McCartney at a time of youth revolution yearning to be 64 years old, right? You have a love song to a cop.
Lovely Rita, meet a maid. May I inquire discreetly, when are you free to take some tea with me?
They're also being mean to poor old Ringo. You know, he only gets by with a little help from his friends. Certainly it's not his talent as a drummer or his looks or even his personality. Only with their help does he get by.
I think you're misreading a couple of those things. I get by with a little help from my friends. I think the key element in this record, with exceptions by Lennon, I might add, Lennon is the exception to the rule here, but in general, the vibe that is being created is one of inclusiveness. So songs like When I'm 64 and She's Leaving Home, yes, they are hat tips to an older generation. It's like they were making an album that your great aunt could listen to.
They were making an album for grandparents. They do not identify with the young woman who is leaving a stultifying home life to explore the world.
Sure.
They're sympathizing with the parents.
Yes, they are.
We gave her everything money could buy.
She's leaving home after living alone for so many years.
It's not a counterculture album. It's not cool. And in some ways, it makes it all the more cool because they were expanding the reach of this record. Now, again, I think that's a noble idea. Summer of Love, all that stuff. You know, the fact that they give Ringo a song to sing, I get by with a little help from my friends.
It's an insulting song.
What is more Summer of Love than that?
Oh, I get by with a little help.
So I understand why this album has a certain amount of charm. It doesn't fit in with a Summer of Love that has Jimi Hendrix and Cream in it. You know what I mean?
Or Velvet Underground.
It's not a rock album. It's not a rock album. But again, I go back to my original premise, Jim. My big concern is not those overall themes, but the songwriting itself. They are not the best Beatles songs. They are, you know, pleasant. They have charm. They have cheek. When I'm 64 is not a very good song at all.
No, it's an awful song.
So With a Little Help from My Friends was done better by Joe Cocker.
All right, so if we are reviewing this on the Sound Opinions Buy It, Try It, Trash It scale today in 2017, because I will say it again, a great piece of art transcends the period and the context in which it was made. What would you give it?
Well, there is one masterpiece on this record, a song called A Day in the Life, which ends the album. That is a magnificent piece of Beatles art.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade.
I don't really have a reason to listen to this record other than that song. I really, if I'm going to reach for Beatles, I'm not going to reach for this. I'm going to go for White Elm. I'm going to go for Revolver.
Yeah.
I'm going to go for Abbey Road. I'm going to go for Rubber Soul.
Or even Meet the Beatles, which is sort of a punk rock record.
You know,
so buy it, try it, trash it.
You know, is it a trash it record? If a new band, let's put it this way, a new band came out today and gave you Sgt. Pepper's, would you trash this record?
No, I would say try it. I would say try it because I really like Being for the Benefit of Mr. Kite, and I like A Day in the Life. If you took those off and combined them with the singles that preceded Pepper's, Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane, and even go back to Paperback Writer and Rain, you know, and some of what would come on Magical Mystery Tour, there's a good album to be had in this mess of 1967 and just before and just after. But this one is a try it.
Yeah, it's a whimsical, charming record. If a new band put this out, I said, you know, there's some promise here. It's a try it record.
Right now, we could use a little bigger me up. Seem like the whole damn nation's trying to take us down. When your brother's dying, mother's crying, TV's lying. All the reasons in the world to push it to me now. See, we thought that we saw that he had a gun. Thought that it looked like it started to run. Thought that we saw that he had a gun. Thought that it looked like it started to run. Am I
That is a little bit of the title track from the second Benjamin Booker album, Witness. The other voice on that song, of course, is Mavis Staples, the great gospel singer out of Chicago. Benjamin Booker grew up in Florida and went to college to study journalism, Jim.
Poor guy.
But you know what? He grew out of it. He moved to New Orleans and started playing gigs there. His imagination for what kind of a band he wanted to be led him to this idea. What if Otis Redding strapped on an electric guitar and played in a punk band?
Yeah.
That was the impetus behind his self-titled 2014 debut. Got a lot of notice. Jack White loved it. He had Benjamin Booker as his opening act during that year. Followed up, went on hiatus, took a trip to Mexico, did some wrestling with what his role should be as an artist. Witness, the album, is his answer. Here is a song from it. It's called Off the Ground from Benjamin Booker on Sound Opinions.
The perk of getting older is learning to ignore the way we feel. And it's been hardly working, hardly working, hardly working out. And it's been hardly working, hardly working, hardly working.
Off the Ground by Benjamin Booker from his second album, Witness. Greg, I love the fact that Benjamin Booker cannot be confined into any one pigeonhole. His heroes, Blind Willie Johnson, The Gun Club, T-Rex, all right? There are elements of punk rock. There are elements of glam rock. There are elements of classic gut bucket blues and R&B and garage rock, and all of it is furious and passionate, and he is particularly inspired right now. This is certainly not the first record where we've been saying this about over the last year. He is inspired about the Black Lives Matter fights, and he's inspired about America's changing attitudes in the era of Trump. When he is singing in Believe, I just want to believe in something. I don't care if it's right or wrong. I just want to believe in something. How can I make it on my own?
I just want to believe in something. I don't care if right or wrong. I just want to believe in something. I cannot make it on my own.
He is questioning. He's not preaching. He's questioning, and he's doing it with a particular instrumental fury. I love the fire in his guitar. I love the vocals. And man, you know, any record that has Mavis on a song as inspiring as Witness is okay with me. You know, this is definitely a buy it record.
This is a record that asks that key question that Mavis helps him answer. Am I going to be a witness, just a witness?
Yeah, am I going to stand on the sidelines or am I going to act?
And he had that revelation when he was in Mexico. He's watching the Black Lives Matter protests taking place, and he's going, you know, what's my role in all this? Am I just going to document it, or am I actually going to participate in it? So it's a profound question that he wrestles with. It's a terse album, 10 songs, 32 minutes, simple and direct, but at the same time broadening his scope both musically and lyrically. You know, the first album was all about this kid going out into the world and struggling. Now he's looking at the world and saying, here's what this world is. Where do I fit in with it?
Well, and he's also showing some range. We get a little bit of Jerry Butler soul on that track, Believe.
Well, I think that's a stunning moment for him because I didn't think he had it in him.
No.
Bit of strings, a little bit of reverb, not too much, not too overdone, really stretching himself musically. There's a lot of people who are saying they miss that raw, rocking sound of that first album. Where'd that go? To me, this is a growth album. He's expanding his reach as an artist. It's a buy it record for me.
How can I make it on my own?
So that's a double buy it for Benjamin Booker and a double try it for Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Do you disagree with these two critics? Give us a call on our hotline, 888-859-1800. Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, we talk to famous session man Ben Montench, who's also a longtime member of Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Well, it started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone. And the sun went down as it crossed the hill. And the town lit up. The world gets still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing. Well, the good old days may not return. Rocks might melt and the seed may burn.
I was talking with a friend of mine. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and next up we've got Ben Montench as our guest on this show. Piano player, organist from Gainesville, Florida, Jim. Longtime friends with Tom Petty and Mike Campbell, who were a big deal back in Florida long before anybody knew them outside of that state. He was first in a band with Tom Petty called Mudcrutch. Then they formed Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers in the mid-70s. You know, since then, Tench has grown in stature and reputation. He has played on numerous recordings by numerous artists, much in demand keyboardist in the L.A. session scene, the consummate sideman in many ways, working with people like Bob Dylan, Stevie Nicks, Johnny Cash, U2, Fiona Apple, and many, many more.
In all that time, Greg, Ben Montench has only released one solo album, You Should Be So Lucky, in 2014. We talked about that and much more when Ben Mont came by, and we began our conversation by asking about how he first met Tom Petty back in Gainesville, Florida.
What happened was there was a music store, and my father helped me get an electric guitar there. And I started haunting the music store. Mm-hmm. I think they let me haunt it, probably thinking that my father would help me buy something else.
Yeah. Well, he was a judge, right?
He was a judge.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this group of older guys. I was like 11, and they were like 14 or 15, who looked intimidating because they had Beatle haircuts. And this was 1964 or 65. Mm-hmm. And in the South, if you have a Beatle haircut, most people have one, and then it kind of flips up in an awkward place because of the humidity. It just doesn't work down there. So there were a bunch of dark-haired guys. One of them had blonde hair, and that was Tom. And so I didn't actually meet him, but I saw him. And he saw me, the kid who came in all the time.
Yeah.
And so I knew, okay, that's – and eventually I figured out, oh, some of those guys are in a band. So I kept haunting the music store, and I wound up at boarding school because – the schools in Gainesville, my parents didn't think they were very good. Mm. Went up to New England, and I came back on a break, and my best friend in Gainesville, two of my best friends, had said, you have to see this band, Mudcrutch. And they took me up to see them play a club, and the blonde guy walks out on stage. And it's like, oh, it's that guy.
That cool guy.
Yeah, so we knew we'd seen each other, but we didn't talk until I was a few years older than that.
I saw you walking down the street with him. You know I almost could have died. I didn't know you had a second friend. I never thought you would have lied.
He's got the biggest band in town. How do you get invited into that band?
Well, here's what happened. Mudcrutch was a known band, so they had some repute. But they were also playing, to make ends meet, a club that had dancers in quotes. And they said, you want to come down and sit in? I was driving my mother's station wagon, and I picked up my Farfisa combo compact organ, which weighed more than I did. They were really heavy, and they still are because I still have one. And I remember dragging it out, looking at lifting it into the back of the station wagon to go sit in with these guys and thinking, do I really want to bring this? Or is this worth it?
Yeah.
Or do I just want to go see him play? Because I love seeing him play. And I went, okay, I'll put it in the car. And I sat in with them. And they said, sit in with us anytime you're around.
Mm.
And so, like, that's the life-changing moment is
wow.
I came so close to just not putting the Farfisa in.
Well, it could have gone either way. If you hadn't sat in, who knows what would have happened, right?
Yeah.
But you were ready for it, too. So how were you ready for that moment?
The 1960s were really interesting. Like, from Elvis to the Beatles coming along and just slamming stuff. It's a real cultural moment in the Renaissance period. So there's all of this stuff going on in my head, and more when I go to a little bit of college. So there's all of this going on, and I'm playing these bands. I was open to all sorts of music.
Yeah.
And what Mudcrutch was playing had all sorts of music in it. And the other thing about that boarding school experience was I was learning how the parts went. This is how Alan Price played this. This is how Dave Roddenberry played this. This is how, you know, so-and-so played this. And I had learned Ray Manzarek's solo from Light My Fire. And a guy looked at me, listened to me play, and said, that's fantastic. What on earth are you doing? I'm like, what do you mean? Because he was really good. He said, that's all wrong. I said, what do you mean? He said, you're playing it like the record. I said, yeah. He said, that's not the point. The point is, how will you play it?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay. And that set me off. And so I was open to be able to play with all these different
That's the
people.
Lesson at 16,
That's
17.
A huge yeah. lesson. Yeah. It's a huge lesson.
And I can't find it. I can't keep myself from wanting you. I can't find it. No matter what you say, no matter what you do.
The perhaps apocryphal story is you're doing some college, but you didn't finish because Mudcrutch asks you to join. And your dad, the judge, said Tom has to make the case.
Well, no, he didn't say that.
Okay.
But Tom didn't make the case. I was in college at Tulane, but on vacation from college, like Christmas, summer, whatever, I was playing with Mudcrutch. Mm. And I was cramming for an economics final because I had to take an elective, and I thought economics would be interesting, and I was wrong. And the phone rings. And it's Tom. I said, what are you doing? He said, playing a set of Naples. He said, what are you doing? I said, cramming for an economics final. He said, what are you doing? Like, literally like that. And I said, you're right. Mm. So I finished the semester and came home, played with Mudcrutch all summer. And the next semester came, and my sister went off to college, and I didn't. I didn't tell my parents.
Oh.
And so after, and I told my parents, yeah, the the women's college starts a little earlier than Tulane does. And I was totally like, how am I going to tell my father? He's going to lose his mind.
Mm.
And he figured it out before I told him.
Uh-huh.
And he was mad.
Yeah.
Like, he was going to throw me out of the house.
Yeah.
My mother was like, no, it's okay. And my father's like, no, if he isn't going to go to college, he's going to earn a living, he's going to make his own way, he's going to get his own party, he's out.
Mm.
And Tom talked to my dad. I don't know what he said. I suspect he said something like, look, if it doesn't work out, he can always go back to school, but we've got a really good band here or whatever.
Mm.
But I think his motivation was that if my parents threw me out of the house, I was going to have to crash on somebody's couch and it might be his. So I think he's like, no, he's not going to get thrown out of his parents' house.
Wouldn't you love to have the tape of what Tom Petty said to your dad?
Oh, Lord, it's one of my great nightmares. I break out in a cold sweat, you know.
But Mudcrutch, the first incarnation, did not go as well as had been hoped. It was... The band never really kind of got to that plane that maybe it deserved at that point.
Well, the truth of the matter is it was a really good live band, but we got in the studio and we sucked in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just sucked.
Did you think you would ever get back together with Tom and give it another go, or did you feel like, man, that's the end of something, it's not going to work?
When Mudcrutch broke up.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was going to go because Mudcrutch broke up. Tom stayed with the record label and was making a solo record. So my friend from boarding school was working at the Village Quarter in Los Angeles and called me up and said, they've given me time to learn to be a recording engineer. If you want to record some of your songs for free, where, you know, like Steely Dan recorded their first album,
mm-hmm.
you know, come in. And I went, okay. And I called Stan Lynch, my friend from Florida, and I said, Stan, we can go in and record. You play drums. I'll get Mike to play guitar. And he said, Ron Blair is a great bass player. I said, get Ron. He's from Gainesville. Mm. So they all came down, and we cut a couple of songs of mine. I had called Tom and said, hey, man, I've never sung on a real microphone. You come in and, like, give a listen and say, you know, sing it, you know, try mm-hmm. it like this and maybe play harmonica on something. He said, sure. And he comes down, and his first wife and I were really close friends. She calls me, like, the next day or 2 days later and says, Tom really liked that band. Mm. And then I get a call, like, a couple of days later, Tom really likes the band, come down to the studio. And it's like, okay. So we gradually brought the band in.
So you put the Heartbreakers together.
Me and Stan.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and Stan put the band together.
Do you ever think he had to take you because you'd put the band together?
Kind of like Bill Wyman had the best amps, so they, you
right,
know,
right,
they
right, took right, up
for the
right,
he also turned out to be the best bass player for the Rolling Stones.
Oh,
possible.
Yes.
Baby, break down. Go ahead, give it to me. Break down, honey, take me through the night.
I was like 19 or something, was starting to review records in college, and this Counterculture Weekly was sending me records to review. And one of the first records I got to review was the Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers debut record. And he goes, I said, do you know anything about these guys? He goes, no, I really don't. I think they're a punk rock band. I mean, look at the guy on the cover. Well, you know, they had Tom in that
it was new wave
bandolier bullets and stuff like that on
it
the cover.
It was no wave.
He was kind of snarling at the camera, you know, or looking very Tom.
Yeah, I know.
And so it was this kind of image, and punk was sort of in the air. So it was kind of taken as part of the new wave, punk rock. And, you know, it was interesting how you guys were marketed back then. You know?
They didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah. They didn't know what to do because the philosophy at the time was we weren't hearing stuff that we liked. Are there really good songs out there that aren't played by people in white satin tight pants with like crazy, wild, you know, frilly stuff going on? Or just where's just the plain straight ahead? Here's some rock and roll with really good songs and a band that plays well. Like not a band that's being fancy, but a band that just plays well. Like where is that? Nobody's doing it. We like it, so let's do it. We didn't say that out loud, but that's what we loved.
What's it like when Tom Petty comes in to rehearsal, jam session, recording session, I don't know, and says, I have this song, I don't know, it's going to be American Girl, American Lady, something, I don't know, whatever. And he plays something like that the first time. What's that like?
He had American Girl, and somebody told me, I don't remember who, yeah, he's got this new song, maybe Mike told me, he's got this new song, and a lot of it doesn't rhyme. And if you think about that first verse, it just doesn't rhyme. I thought, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
And I came in, and they had cut the track. It's kind of an odd sound, and Mike had already put that synthesizer at the beginning that goes,
leads it in. Yeah.
I'm like, wow, this is fantastic. And then I realized, oh, this is called American Girl. It's right today is July 4th, 1976. It's actually the bicentennial.
Yeah.
And we're recording a song with American in the title. That's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if anybody will ever hear it. But when he brings a song in, usually he just shows it on the piano or he shows it on the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
He says we're a tough room.
Because
I think that if we don't like the song, we don't say, oh, God, that's awful. But I think we just don't play it very well.
The enthusiasm doesn't come back.
The enthusiasm. I will try, but, you know, we give total respect to anything that he brings in, or him and Mike. But usually he just brings it in and we throw it around and he's got an idea or two. And
but you're such a keen listener and a student of musical history, and you have exquisite taste. I say that because you agree with us mostly. Do you know when it's an American Girl, it's a Free Fallin', it's one of those songs, and you just say, this is really special. This is going to be the one.
I knew when it was a Free Fallin'.
Okay.
Because that record got made. Nobody told me, so I'm like planning to start a Heartbreakers record. Mm. And I called up Bugs, who's the crew chief, and said, so Wednesday, this was like Monday or something, so what time Wednesday? And Bugs goes, what? I said, well, they said we were going to start a record on Wednesday. And he goes, nobody told you? I'm like, told me what? He's like, Tom's making a solo record with Mike and Jeff Lynne. He's not using the band. And I'm like, what? So at the same time, my dear friend and business manager and I were talking, and I said, damn it. He said, great. It'll take him 6 weeks. Now you can go to rehab. And so that solo record saved my life. After a month in rehab, I go over to see how they're doing and just say hi. And I walk in, and he's putting the vocal on Free Fall. Hmm. And he's standing in the control room with just a couple of speakers and not using headphones. And I walk in and the song starts. And he sings the first couple of lines.
She's a good girl, loves her mama, loves Jesus in America too.
And he finishes the take and I was like, that's fantastic. Can I play something on it? Hmm. You know, I'd really like to play something on it. And Jeff kind of shuddered because he knows that I play organ and he hates Hammonds. And he's like, oh, maybe a Vox Continental. And I'm like, and I dropped it. But I knew that was special.
Yeah.
I really knew that was special. I really wanted to play on that.
After a short break, we'll hear more from our guest Ben Montench as we explore his career as a session musician, working with Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, and more. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX. Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And today we are talking to keyboardist Ben Montench of the long-running and iconic rock band Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. You know, outside of that career with the Heartbreakers, Greg, Tench has been a successful sideman, a much-in-demand session musician, working with everyone from Stevie Nicks to Bob Dylan to Brian Eno. Someone who really helped launch his career as a session musician was producer Jimmy Iovine, one of the founders of Interscope Records. Iovine got to know Tench through producing Heartbreakers albums in and around 1980. And then he invited Tench to work with Stevie Nicks to prepare her for her first solo album. And from there, the rest of the session career took off.
What happened with my session career, I'd done a few little sessions, but Jimmy was going to produce Stevie Nicks' first solo album. And he called me up and said, will you go hang out with Stevie Nicks and listen to her songs and help her get them in order you know, and just in go through them and see what you think like best and get them in rough shape and play them with her to preparatory to this record. And I'd seen Fleetwood Mac with Stevie, and Stevie was obviously really good, but my heart was with Christine and Lindsay and Mick and John.
Mm-hmm.
And then I heard Silver Springs, like just the B-side of Go Your Own Way, and I thought that was immaculate and moving. Mm. And I'm like, and that was what was in my head when Jimmy said, do you want to go do something with Stevie Nicks? And I said, yeah.
You could be my silver spring, blue-green colors flashing. I would be your only dream, your shining autumn ocean crashing.
So I hung out with Stevie, and it was great. Playing on that record, I met Chuck Plotkin, I met Waddy Wachtel, Bob Klaub, Russ Kunkel, Bobby Hall Porter, David Johnson, and
this is the royalty.
This is the royalty of Los Angeles recording session musicians, and I learned a lot, and I got to play with some really great people. And the next thing that Jimmy did was call me up and say, "I'm going to produce a song for Bob Dylan. I don't know anybody there. Will you come?" And I went, yeah. And I went down to the recording session, and I knew Shelley was engineering it, and I knew Jimmy, who was producing it. I knew nobody else. And Bob came in late and went across the room with his sunglasses on, didn't say anything to anybody, and we played. Jimmy left in the middle of the session. Unbeknownst to me, I come back for a playback. Jimmy's gone, Shelley's gone. Now I know nobody in the recording session. I'm in a recording session with a bunch of strangers and Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
I'm like, what on earth? I found out later that Jimmy felt insulted by something Bob said. I've heard contradictory reports. One was very insulting. The other just sounded like Bob making a sincere request. Like, I heard that Jimmy said, "What do you want to cut next?" And Bob said, "I hear this is the studio where Bing Crosby cut White Christmas. Why don't you go get out and get the sheet music and we'll cut White Christmas?" Which to me just really sounds sincere.
Yeah.
But Jimmy said he was really offended because he thought he was giving him a hard time.
This is a great moment, Benmont, to sort of describe how much instruction do you get when you're called in on a session typically? Is it kind of like, hey, just play Benmont and do your thing? Or do they give you specific ideas of what they want? I mean, what's the general, like a Dylan session?
If they have a very specific idea of what they want, they usually don't ask me back again.
Uh-huh.
I just don't learn well. You know, sometimes, like if Tom writes a song on the piano, he'll have a really cool, simple part. And on Hope You Never, we were going to put an electric harpsichord solo, and I tried, and he went, "No, play it like this." And I tried, and no two players have the same feel. And he played the solo himself, the end. When Bob wrote stuff on the piano, when I would do a little recording with Bob, he would usually wind up playing the piano because nobody has that feel. And I would try to do it and be like, "No, you play piano, I'll play organ."
All right, one more session question, and I want to talk to you about your solo album. You got to play with Brian Eno.
I did, man.
Yeah.
Listen, I get a call. "Would you be interested in doing something with Brian Eno?"
Mm.
I'm like, yes,
mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely. And Eno was producing U2 and Talking Heads and stuff like that by then. But I'm like, that's great. He says, he's in town. He records, manipulates the recording, and then does a lecture the next day and presents the recording. Great. I said, "Why me?" He said, "Well, it was down to you and somebody else, but he liked your name." He had no idea who I was. He just liked my name. And it's like, okay, so what's the deal? Like, well, it's Benmont Tench, and the drummer is Sugarfoot Moffat.
Yeah.
And the bass player was Romeo somebody.
Yeah.
And we go into the studio, and he's got some synthesizer for me. And I say, I'm going through the sounds, trying to find a sound. I say, "What do you think I should play? What sound are you thinking?" And he hits a button. He says, "Try this one." Every key on the synthesizer plays a different drum or percussion instrument.
Mm.
And that's what it was. There was no notes at all.
Huh.
And I'm going, trying to figure out what on earth I'm doing. And from the control room, Eno goes, perfect, play that, play that. And when I hold up my two fingers, play something else. When I hold up my first finger again, go back to that. And that's what we did. And and at the end of the day, which was a really great day, he said, thanks a million. And he edited it together and played it at UCLA or USC and put it out on NerveNet.
I do have to ask you one other. I mean, Hurt is just Johnny Cash doing Hurt is one of the most staggering performances I've ever heard, and you're all over that. How did that work out?
Rick Rubin.
Yeah.
He and Cash were really, really close. They became really close. And he did that first record that was all acoustic. And then the second record, I think, is the one that he wanted the Heartbreakers to be a band on it. We went down to play with Rick, and Rick kept me in the loop and Mike when he made the more acoustic records later, and we went over to Rick's house once. I've always thought that was a really spectacular song.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And Trent Reznor's a really, really good songwriter, like a really from-the-heart songwriter. The idea and what Cash found in it as a different source of hurt.
Yeah.
And coming at it as somebody nearing the end of their life and that kind of accumulation over your life.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real.
Now, God bless Rick. Rick brought me in to do some wonderful stuff with a lot of wonderful people. But working with Johnny Cash, we'd talked about it for a long time and never pulled it off. And then on St. Andrews and Wilshire, maybe at St. James Church, I don't know, in Los Angeles, had a day free, and we went down. And I played a church organ, and I didn't know how to pull all those crazy buttons. Mm. So the church organist sat next to me.
And there's all those pedals,
and,
right?
And he was great. He was really instinctive. I said, I can give you a nod where to, like, make it bigger or swell or whatever. And I tried that once, and he was way ahead of me. He got it. And I played the church organ, and it was set up, and you would look into a mirror, and you could see the preacher's chair. And, you know.
Yeah.
So that they could take the cues or whatever from the preacher,
right.
Start the hymn. And Cash was sitting in this beautiful carved wooden preacher's chair, and June was sitting next to him.
Hmm.
The recording engineer was there, and Rick was there. And that was it. Hmm. And we cut Danny Boy.
Oh, Danny Boy, the pipes are calling from glen to glen and down the mountainside.
And being in a church and seeing Cash with headphones on, sitting there over the microphone, singing, not just singing, the experience of that.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that. The things that I've got to do, not just in The Heartbreakers, which are a whole nother world, but we were playing Gothenburg, Sweden with Bob. And, you know, I didn't talk to Bob much. I'm intimidated. At a certain point, we'd play a ballad, and it would be, I'll Remember You or some other song or Sweetheart Like You or something like that. And we're walking on, and I'm next to Bob, and I turn to him, I say, so do you want to do I'll Remember You, or what do you want to do in that spot? And he says, do you know tomorrow is a long time? I'm like, yes, I know tomorrow is a long time. We never rehearsed that. He said, we'll do that, just you and me.
Hmm. Wow.
And I'm like, okay. And so we went out, and in an arena with 15 or 20,000 people, we played Tomorrow is a Long Time, just me and Bob. And then we played Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, which we'd never played. And that's why I play music. That's precisely why I play music. For that. Just for that. And Bob, I think, you get the real guy, and maybe he might be a little cranky at some times, but you get the real guy. And I've seen him when I've just gone to see him, and I've watched him and gone, he's just playing some blues, this is okay, but it's like whatever. And then all of a sudden, they hit a chord, and he starts singing Not Dark Yet, and the whole real Bob Dylan shows up. Mm. And as an audience member, it's stunning. But if you are playing with an artist, when that light shines through them and comes out, there's nothing like it.
Shadows are falling, and I've been here all day. It's too hot to sleep, and time is running away.
Maybe a good place to end, where many other people would have started. You're a late bloomer. 2014, you should be so lucky. You finally put out a solo album. 2014.
Yeah.
One in all these years.
Well, you know, I didn't have the nerve. And Glenn John said to me 10 years ago, if you ever want to make a record, let's make a record. And I'm like, he's just, it was like when Mudcrutch said, sit in. I thought, oh, he's just being nice.
Yeah.
And like 10 years later, I had had a few things happen in my life, and I had some songs, better songs or old songs that I had made better. And I was like, hey, these songs showed up for a reason. I don't want them never to be heard. And I liked the songs. And I called Glenn, and he said, sure, when you want to do it. My friends, who were my favorite players outside of the Heartbreakers, we went in and made a record. And I played a couple of shows then, and I've started playing shows again.
Mm-hmm.
And I've started playing entirely solo, which is really strange for a guy that's always been in a band.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to do it because I have friends who go out and play solo. And it's like there are things I haven't done in life. I want to do them.
Mm-hmm.
But when I played a couple of solo gigs this last fall, I found, oh, I really enjoy this. I really do enjoy this. The older I get, the more I like to hear songs with just the songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Music, I think, can really easily turn into this thing where, okay, it's starting with just a piano and a voice. There's a drum fill comes in, the band comes in the chorus something will happen, the second verse, the organ or the background voice. It's like you tune out because you know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't hear the song because I'll hear it because it's that structure just kind of glosses over me. And if it's just a songwriter singing, then I hear the song.
Yeah.
I'm not playing solo shows or making a solo record to like try to go ego gratification, this kind of thing. I'm really not. It's like I really like the songs. And so I want people to hear the songs.
Yeah.
That's it. It's just like,
no, it's a fun record. There's this quiet, seductive charm to this
thank
record.
Thank you.
Can you play us out? Would you give us one of those?
I can play you out. There's an instrumental song called Wobbles.
I was going to say that. It's here in New Orleans.
Check this out. Check this out, though. See if you like it.
I could talk to you guys for a long time.
Yeah, well, you already have written Dolce.
I know I have.
This song is called Wobbles, and on my record, on the You Should Be So Lucky album, it's like... So, it's called Wobbles because I have a friend named Wobbles, and she lives on Esplanade, and there were no lyrics when I recorded this. But a day later, the lyrics showed up, and the lyrics were like this, let's see. When the night leaves the quarter and the dawn's light kisses the river, that's the time when I first saw her, my darling,
she was wobbling down Esplanade. See her stop, sway and shimmy. What she got, she got plenty. Yes, she sought out, oh, by so many, my darling, and she's wobbling down Esplanade. Oh, ain't she something? Lost in the rhythm, what I give her to be with her, Lord, to kiss her as she's wobbling down Esplanade.
Ben Montench with Wobbles from his, well, that's actually an add-on to that brilliant solo record that you put out, You Should Be So Lucky.
That's the Sound Opinions exclusive version.
Sound Opinions exclusive with the lyric. And if you can listen to the record, you'll go, why did he put a lyric to that? Because it showed up.
No,
because you felt it at the moment.
Thank you so much, Ben Mont, for being our guest on Sound Opinions.
Thanks for having me. I've always wanted to do your show, and now I have.
That wraps up our conversation with Ben Montench, and we've got exclusive video of his performance on our show at soundopinions.org. Do you have an opinion about Ben Mont or have a favorite Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers song? Please share it with us by calling 888-859-1800.
Greg, what's on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we're going to take a virtual road trip playing our favorite songs about cities, states, and regions of the country along the way.
Sounds like fun, Greg. We have some thank yous to say on the way out. Adam Yaffe and Andrew Gill helped with our session with Ben Montench. Sound Opinions is produced by Brendan Banizak, Evan Chung, Alex Claiborne, and Ayana Contreras. On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
Call me, won't you use my number?
New messages.
Hey, Greg and Jim. It is Luis calling from Bloomington, Indiana. I just finished listening to your show on analog versus digital. It was really good to hear someone say that all the formats have their place. MP3s, streaming, CDs, vinyl. And we can use them when they're appropriate in the best way to listen to music. Also wanted to comment on my example of what you're calling thick listening. If you take a listen to the album cut of Life on Mars from David Bowie on Hunky Dory, the last 8 to 10 seconds you'll actually hear the phone ringing in the studio. And I think it's Mick Ronson kind of getting angry at the fact that the take that they had just done was ruined. So they rewound the tape, laid down the final take of the song, which ended up being 8 to 10 seconds shorter than the previous take. And little did they know that they still had that phone ringing on the final master. So a great example, I think, of what you're talking about with thick listening. Keep up the good work. Great show. Thanks.
Hey, guys. This is Jeff Irick calling from Westchester County, New York. Just listening to your podcast about the 12-string Rickenbacker. And you played a little snip of A Million Miles Away by the Plimsolls, which... is a record I produced back in the 80s, and it was great to hear it. Thank you so much. But you didn't mention the Fender 12-string. I used to play bass with Tim Buckley, and Tim was playing a Fender 12-string tuned down to C, which is two whole steps lower, which gave it a great sound, and made it a lot easier to play, too, because the strings were looser, obviously. Thanks for everything. Talk to you soon.
Sometimes I think about Saturday's child and all about the times when we were running wild.
Hello, this is Nathan Rose from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Loved that episode about 12-string guitars. Basically, the band Black Angels defies everything you said about 12-string guitars. They use heavy fuzz tone, do a nice overtone lead at the end, especially on their new song, Half Believing, off their new album. Black Angels use the 12-string all the time for fuzzed-out, psych sounds that take on a much more contemporary feel than something like the Beatles. Anyway, great show. Thanks so much for talking about music. Bye.
Hey, this is Kevin Case from Concord, California, longtime listener. Just got done listening to your Rickenbacker special. Noticed you didn't mention the Church. Geez, not necessarily jangly pop, kind of more... I would say kind of gloom pop, maybe. Lots of lavishly played Rickenbackers on there. Thanks, man. Keep it up. Bye.
The king had something changed within him. I should have told him no. Oh, Columbus, I never should have let you go.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.